Side 3. Domes of Fire. The Tomilly, Book 1. By David Eddings. Continuing on page 83. Even as Dolmont's ascension to the throne had changed him, so Ortsel had been changed by living in Kyrellos. He no longer seemed to be quite the same rigid, provincial man he had been in Lamorkand. Although he was by no means as worldly as Emban, he had nonetheless acquired some of the sophistication of his colleagues in the Basilica. He smiled occasionally now, and he appeared to be developing a sly, understated sense of humor. Sparhawk had met with him on several occasions since Dolmont had ordered the cleric to Kyrellos, and the big Pandion found that he was actually beginning to like the man. Ortsel still had his prejudices, of course, but he was now willing to admit that points of view other than his own might have some small validity.
"Somebody just made him up," Uloth was saying incredulously. "Oh, no. There was somebody named Drichnoth 4,000 years ago. Probably some bully boy with his brains in his biceps. I'd imagine that he was the usual sort. No neck, no forehead, and nothing even remotely resembling intelligence between his ears. After he died, though, some poet struggling with failing inspiration seized on the story and embellished it with all the shop-worn conventions of the heroic epic. He called it the Drichnatha Saga, and Lamorkand would be far better off if the poet had never learned to read and write." Sparhawk thought he detected some actual flashes of humor there.
"One poem could hardly have that kind of impact, Your Grace," Calton said skeptically.
"You underestimate the power of a well-told story, Sir Calton. I'll have to translate as I go along. But judge for yourself."
Ortsel leaned back with his eyes half closed.
"Hearken unto a tale from the age of heroes," he began.
His harsh, rigid voice became softer, more sonorous, as he recited the ancient poem.
"List, brave men of Lamorkland, to the exploits of Drichnoth the smith, mightiest of all the warriors of yore. Now, as all men know, the age of heroes was an age of bronze. Massive were the bronze swords and the axes of the heroes of yore, and mighty were the thews of the men who wielded them in joyous battle. And none there was in all the length and breadth of Lamorkland mightier than Drichnoth the smith. Tall was Drichnoth, and ox-shouldered, for his labor molded him, even as he molded the glowing metal. Swords of bronze wrought he, and spears as keen as daggers, and axes, and shields, and burnished helms, and shirts of mail which shed the foeman's blows as they were no more than gentle rain. And lo, warriors from all of dark-forested Lamorkland gladly gave good gold and bright silver beyond measure in exchange for Drichnoth's bronze. And the mighty smith waxed in wealth and in strength as he toiled at his forge."
Sparhawk tore his eyes from Ortsel's face and looked around. The faces of his friends were all rapt. The patriarch of Kadok's voice rose and fell in the stately cadences of bardic utterance.
"Lord," Sir Bevier breathed as the patriarch paused, "it's hypnotic, isn't it?"
"That's always been its danger," Ortsel told him. "The rhythm numbs the mind and sets the pulse to racing. The people of my race are susceptible to the emotionality of the Drichnatha Saga. An army of Lamorks can be whipped into a frenzy by a recitation of some of the more lurid passages."
"Well," Talon said eagerly, "what happened?"
Ortsel smiled rather gently at the boy.
"Surely so worldly a young thief cannot be stirred by some tired old poem," he suggested slyly.
Sparhawk nearly laughed aloud. Perhaps the change in the patriarch of Kadok had gone further than he had imagined.
"I like a good story," Talon admitted. "I've never heard one told that way before, though."
"It's called felicity of style," Stragan murmured. "Sometimes it's not so much what the story says, but how it says it."
"Well," Talon insisted, "what happened?"
"Drichnoth discovered that a giant named Kringle had forged a metal that could cut bronze like butter," Ortsel replied conversationally. "He went to Kringle's lair with only his sledgehammer for a weapon, tricked the secret of the new metal out of the giant, and then beat out his brains with the sledge. Then he went home and began to forge the new metal, steel, and hammered it out into weapons. Soon every warrior in Lamorkand, or Lamorkland, as they called it in those days, had to have a steel sword, and Drichtnath grew enormously wealthy. He frowned. "I hope you'll bear with me," he apologized. "Translating on the spot is a bit difficult." He thought a while, and then began again to recite. Now it came to pass that the fame of the mighty smith Drichtnath spread throughout the land. Tall was he, a full 10 span, I ween, and broad were his shoulders. His thews were as the steel from his forge, and comely were his features. Full many a maid of noble house yearned for him in the silences of her soul. Now, as it chanced to happen in those far-off days of yore, the ruler of the Lamorks was the aged King Higdal, whose snowy locks bespoke his wisdom. No son in life had he, but a daughter, the child of his eld, fair as morning dew, and yclept Uta. And Higdal was sore troubled, for well he wot that when his spirit had been gathered to the bosom of Hraka, strife and contention would rack the lands of the Lamorks as the heroes vied with one another for his throne and for the hand of fair Uta in marriage. For such was the twin prize which would fall to the victor. And so resolved King Higdal at last to secure the future of realm and daughter with one stroke, and caused he to be sent word to every corner of his vasty realm. The fate of Lamorkland and of bright-eyed Uta would be decided by trial at arms. The mightiest hero in all the land would win wealth, wife, and dominion by the strength of his hands. "What's a span?" Talon interrupted.
9 inches, Barrett replied. "It's supposed to be as far as a man can stretch out the fingers of one hand."
Talon made the quick computation in his head.
7.5 feet? He said incredulously. He was 7.5 feet tall?
It may be slightly exaggerated. Ortzel smiled.
"Who is this Hraka?"
Bevier asked him. "The Lamork war god," Ortzel explained. "There was a period at the end of the Bronze Age when the Lamorks reverted to paganism. Obviously, Drichtnath won the trial at arms, and he didn't even kill too many other Lamorks in the process." Ortzel cleared his throat and took up his recitation. "And so it was that Drichtnath the Smith, mightiest hero of antiquity, won the hand of bright-eyed Uta, and became King Higdal's heir. And when the wedding feast was done, went Higdal's heir straightway to the king. 'Lord King,' quotha, 'since I have the honor to be the mightiest warrior in all the world, it is only meet that the world fall into my hands. To that end shall I bend mine efforts once Hraka hath called thee home. I will conquer the world, and subdue it, and bend it to my will, and I will lead the heroes of Lamorkland e'en unto Kyrellos. There will I cast down the altars of the false god of that church, which doth, all womanly, hold strength in despite, and weakens warriors with her drasty preaching. I spurn her counsel, and will lead the heroes of Lamorkland forth to bear back to our homes in groaning wains the loot of the world.' Happily heard Higdal the hero's words, for Hraka, sword lord of Lamorkland, glories in battle strife, and doth inspire his children to love the sound of sword meeting sword, and the sight of sparkling blood bedewing the grass. 'Go forth, my son, and conquer,' quotha. 'Punish the Peloi, crush the Camorians, destroy the Deerans, and forget not to bring down the church, which doth pollute the manhood of all Alenes with her counsels of peace and lowly demeanor.' Now when word of Drichtnath's design reached the Basilica of Kyrellos, the church was troubled and trembled in fear of the mighty smith, and the princes of the church took counsel one with the other and resolved to spill out the life of the noble smith, lest his design dispossess the church and win her wealth to wend in wains Lamorkward, there to bedeck the high-built walls of the conqueror's mead hall. Conspired they then to send a warrior of passing merit to the court of Higdal's heir,
to bring low the towering pride of dark-forested Lamorkland. In dissembling guise, this traitorous warrior, a Deeran by birth, Starkad was his name, made his way to Drichtnoth's mead hall, and mildly made he courteous greeting to Higdal's heir, and beseeched he the hero of Lamorkland to accept him as his vassal. Now Drichtnoth's heart was so free of deceit and subterfuge that he could not perceive perfidy in others. Gladly did he accept Starkad's seeming friendship, and the two were soon as brothers, even as Starkad had designed. And as the heroes of Drichtnoth's hall labored, Starkad was ever at Drichtnoth's right hand, in fair weather and foul, in battle and in the carouse which is battle's aftermath. Tales he spun which filled Drichtnoth's heart with mirth, and for the love he bare his friend, did the mighty smith gladly bestow treasures upon him, bracelets of bright gold, and gems beyond price. Starkad accepted Drichtnoth's gifts in seeming gratitude, and ever, like the patient worm, burrowed he his way ever deeper into the hero's heart. And at the time of Haraka's choosing, was wise King Higdal gathered into the company of the immortal thanes in the Hall of Heroes, and then was Drichtnoth king in Lamorkland. Well were laid his plans. And no sooner had the royal crown been placed upon his head that he gathered his heroes and marched north to subdue the savage Paloi. Many were the battles mighty Drichtnoth waged in the lands of the Paloi, and great were the victories he won. And there it was, in the lands of the horse people, that the design of the Church of Kyrellos was accomplished. For there, separated from their friends by legions of ravening Paloi, Drichtnoth and Starkad wrought slaughter upon the foe, bathing the meadow's grass with the blood of their enemies. And there, in the full flower of his heroism, was mighty Drichtnoth laid full low. Seizing upon a lull in the struggle, when all stood somewhat apart to gather breath and strength to renew the struggle, the deceitful Deeran found his opportunity and drove his cursed spear, sharper than any dagger, full into his lord's broad back. And Drichtnoth felt death's cold touch as Starkad's bright steel pierced him. And turned he then to face the man he had called friend and brother. "Why," quotha, his heart wrung more by the betrayal than by Starkad's stroke. "It was in the name of the god of the Alenes," quoth Starkad, with hot tears streaming from his eyes, for in truth loved he the hero he had just slain. "Think not that it was I who have smitten thee to the heart, my brother, for it was not I, but our holy mother Church which hath sought thy life." So saying, he raised once more his dreadful spear. "Defend thyself, Drichtnoth, for though I must slay thee, I would not murder thee." Then raised noble Drichtnoth his face. "That will I not do," quotha, "for if my brother have need of my life, I give it to him freely." "Forgive me," quoth Starkad, raising again his deadly spear. "That may I not do," quoth the hero. "My life mayest thou freely have, but never my forgiveness." "So be it then," quoth Starkad, and so saying plunged he his deadly spear full into Drichtnoth's mighty heart. A moment only the hero stood, and then slowly, as falls the mighty oak, fell all the pride of Lamorkland, and the earth and the heavens resounded with his fall. There were tears in Talon's eyes.
"Did he get away with it?" he asked. "I mean, didn't one of Drichtnoth's other friends pay him back?"
The boy's face clearly showed his eagerness to hear more. "Surely you wouldn't want to waste your time with some tired, worn-out old story that's been around for thousands of years," Ortsil said. He feigned some astonishment, but there was a sly twinkle in his eye. Sparhawk covered his own smile with his hand. Ortsil had definitely changed all right. "I don't know about Talon," Olaf said. But I would. There were obviously some strong similarities between the culture of present-day Thalesia and that of ancient Lamorkland. Well now, Ortzel said, I'd say that some bargaining might be in order here. How many acts of contrition would the two of you be willing to give our Holy Mother in exchange for the rest of the story? Ortzel, Dolmont reproved him. The Patriarch of Kadok held up one hand. It's a perfectly legitimate exchange, Sarathi, he said. The Church has used it many times in the past. When I was a simple country pastor, I used this exact method to ensure regular attendance at services. My congregation was known far and wide for its piety, until I ran out of stories. Then he laughed. They were all a bit startled at that. Most of them would have bet that the stern, unbending Patriarch of Kadok didn't even know how. I was only teasing, he told the young thief and the gigantic Thalesian. I wouldn't be too disappointed, however, if the two of you gave the condition of your souls some serious thought. Tell the story, Mirtai insisted. Mirtai was also a warrior, and also, it appeared, susceptible to a stirring tale. Do I sense the possibility of a convert here? Ortzel asked her. What you're sensing is the possibility of failing health, Ortzel, she said bluntly. Mirtai never used titles when she spoke to people. All right, then. Ortzel laughed again and continued with his translation. Hearken then, O men of Lamorkland, and hear how Starkad was paid. Some tears then shed he over his fallen brother. Then turned he his raging wrath upon the Faloi, and they fled screaming from him. Straightway left he the strife place, and journeyed even to the holy city of Kyrellos, there to advise the princes of the Church that their design was done. And when they had gathered all in the basilica, which is the crown of their o'erweening pride, recounted Starkad the sad tale of the fall of Drychnoth, mightiest hero of yore. And gloated then the soft and pampered princes of the Church at the hero's fall, thinking that their pride and power and position were safe, and spake they each in praise of Starkad, and offered him good gold beyond measure for the deed he had done. Cold, however, was the hero's heart, and he looked upon the little men he had served, recalling with tears the great man he had slain at their bidding. Lordlings of the Church, quoth of them, think ye that mere gold will satisfy me as payment for what I have done in your behalf? But what else may we offer thee? They asked in great perplexity. I would have Drychnoth's forgiveness, quoth Starkad. But that we may not obtain for thee, they said unto him, for dreaded Drychnoth lieth low in the house of the dead, from whence no man returneth. Pray, mighty hero, tell us what else we may offer thee in recompense for this great service thou hast provided us. But one thing, quoth Starkad in deadly earnest. And that is what? They asked. Your heart's blood, quoth Starkad. And so saying, sprang he to the massy door and chained it shut with chains of steel that none might escape him. Then drew he forth Hlorithin, dread Drychnoth's bright blade, which he had brought with him to Kyrellos for just this purpose, and then took the hero Starkad his payment for the deed he had done on the plains of the Paloi. And when he had finished collecting that which was owed him, the Church of Kyrellos lay headless, for not one of her princes saw the setting of the sun that day, and sorrowing still that he had slain his friend, Starkad sadly took his leave of the holy city, and never returned there more. But it is said in dark-forested Lamorkland that the oracles and the auguries speak still of the mighty Drychnoth, and of the day when the war-god Haraka will relent and release the spirit of Drychnoth from his service as one of the immortal thanes in the Hall of Heroes, that he may come once more to Lamorkland to take up again that grand design. Then how the blood will flow, and then how the kings of the world will tremble as once again the world shakes beneath the mighty stride of dread Drychnoth the Destroyer, and the crown and throne of the world shall lie in his immortal grip, as was from the beginning intended.
Ortsil's voice fell silent, indicating that he had reached the end.
That's all?
Talon protested vehemently. I skipped over a great number of passages, Ortsil conceded. Battle descriptions and the like. The Lamorks of antiquity had an unhealthy fascination with certain kinds of numbers. They wanted to know how many barrels of blood, pounds of brains, and yards of entrails were spilled out during the festivities.
But the story doesn't end right, Talon complained. Drychnoth was the hero, but after Starkad murdered him, he turned into the hero. That isn't right. The bad people shouldn't be allowed to change over like that.
That's a very interesting argument, Talon, particularly coming from you.
I'm not a bad person, Your Grace. I'm just a thief. It's not the same at all.
At least the churchmen all got what was coming to them.
You have a long way to go with this one, Sparhawk, Bevier observed. We all loved Kirik like a brother, but are we really sure that his son has the makings of a church knight in him?
I'm working on that, Sparhawk replied, musing. So that's what Drychnoth's all about. Just how deeply do the commons in Lamorkand believe in the story, Your Grace?
It goes deeper than belief, Sparhawk, Ortsil replied. The story's in our blood. I'm wholly committed to the church. But when I hear the Drychnatha saga, I become an absolute pagan. For a while, at least.
Well, Tinian said, now we know what we're up against. We have the same thing going on in Lamorkand as we have in Rendor. We've got heresies springing up all around us. It still doesn't solve our problem, though. How are Sparhawk and the rest of us going to be able to go to Tamuli without insulting the Emperor?
I've solved that problem already, Tinian, Elana told him.
I beg your Majesty's pardon.
It's so simple that I'm almost ashamed that you all didn't think of it first.
Enlighten us, Your Majesty, Stragan said. Make us blush for our stupidity.
It's time for the Western Ilian kingdoms to open communications with the Tamil Empire, she explained. We are neighbors, after all. It's politically very sound for me to make a state visit to Mathirion, and if you gentlemen are all very nice to me, I'll invite you to come along.
She frowned.
That was the least of our problems. Now we'll have to address something far more serious.
And what is that, Elana? Dolmont asked her.
I simply don't have a thing to wear, Sarathi.
Chapter 6 Sparhawk had learned to keep a tight rein on his emotions during the years since his marriage to the Queen of Alenia, but his smile was slightly fixed as the meeting broke up. Colton fell in beside him as they all left the council chamber.
I gather that you're less than pleased with our Queen's solution to the problem, he observed.
Colton was Sparhawk's boyhood friend, and he had learned how to read that battered face.
You might say that, yes. Sparhawk replied tightly. Are you open to a suggestion?
I'll listen.
Sparhawk didn't want to make any promises at that particular point.
Why don't you and I go down into the crypt under the basilica?
Why?
I thought you might want to vent certain feelings before you and your wife discuss the matter.
You're a bit of a savage when you're angry, Sparhawk, and I'm really very fond of your wife. If you call her an idiot to her face, you'll hurt her feelings.
Are you trying to be funny?
Not in the least, my friend. I feel almost the same way about it as you do. And I've had a very colorful education. When you run out of swear words, I'll supply some you might not have heard.
Let's go, Sparhawk said, turning abruptly down a side corridor.
They passed through the nave quickly, perfunctorily genuflecting to the altar in passing, and descended into the crypt that contained the bones of several eons worth of archprelates.
Don't bang your fists on the walls, Colton cautioned, as Sparhawk began to pace up and down, swearing and waving his arms in the air. You'll break your knuckles. It's a total absurdity, Colton, Sparhawk said, after he had shouted profanities for several minutes. It's worse than that, my friend. There's always room in the world for absurdities. They're sort of fun, actually. But this is dangerous. We have no way of knowing what we're going to encounter in Tamale. I love your wife dearly, but having her along is going to be inconvenient.
Inconvenient?
I'm trying to be polite. How does bloody hindering awkward strike you?
It's closer.
You'll never persuade her to stay home, though. I'd give that up as a lost cause before I even started.
She's obviously made up her mind, and she outranks you.
You probably ought to try to put the best face on it. Avoid the embarrassment of being told to shut your mouth and go to your room.
Sparhawk grunted. I think our best approach is to talk with Oscania. We'll be taking the most precious thing in Alenia to the Darisian continent, where things are far from tranquil. Your wife's going there is a personal favor to the Emperor of Tamale, so he's obligated to protect her. An escort of a few dozen legions of Atons meeting us at the Astel border might be looked upon as a sign of His Majesty's appreciation, wouldn't you say?
That's really not a bad idea, Colton.
I'm not totally stupid, Sparhawk. Now, Aelana's going to expect you to rant and rave and wave your arms at her. She's ready for that. So don't do it. She is going along. We've lost that fight already, wouldn't you say?
Unless I chain her to the bed.
There's an interesting idea.
Never mind.
It's tactically unsound to fight a last stand unless you're trapped. Give her that victory, and then she'll owe you one. Use it to get her to agree not to do anything while we're in Tamale without your express permission. That way, we can keep her almost as safe as she'd be if she stayed home. There's a good chance that she'll be so happy that you didn't scream at her that she'll agree without thinking it all the way through. You'll be able to restrict her movements when we get there. At least enough to keep her out of danger.
Colton, sometimes you amaze me, Sparhawk told his friend.
I know, the blonde Pandion replied. This stupid-looking face of mine is very useful sometimes.
Where did you ever learn so much about manipulating royalty?
I'm not manipulating royalty, Sparhawk. I'm manipulating a woman, and I'm an expert at that. Women are born negotiators. They love these little trades. If you go to a woman and say, I'll do this for you, if you do that for me, she'll almost always be willing at least to talk about it. Women always want to talk about things. If you keep your eye on what you really want, you'll almost always come out on top.
He paused.
Metaphorically speaking, of course, he added.
What are you up to, Sparhawk? Mirtai asked him suspiciously when he approached the suite of rooms Dolmont had provided for Aelana and her personal retinue. Sparhawk carefully let the smug expression slide from his face and assumed one of grave concern instead.
Don't try to be clever, Sparhawk, she told him. If you hurt her, I'll have to kill you, you know.
I'm not going to hurt her, Mirtai. I'm not even going to yell at her.
You're up to something, aren't you?
Of course I am. After you lock me inside, put your ear to the door and listen.
He gave her a sidelong look.
But you do that all the time anyway, don't you?
She actually blushed.
She jerked the door open. Just get in there, Sparhawk, she commanded, her face like a thundercloud.
My, aren't we testy tonight?
Go.
Yes, ma'am.
Aelana was ready for him. That much was fairly obvious. She was wearing a dressing gown of a pale rose that made her look particularly appealing, and she had done things with her hair. There was a barely noticeable tightness about her eyes, though.
Good evening, love, Sparhawk said calmly. Tedious day, wasn't it? Conferences can be so exhausting at times.
He crossed the room, pausing to kiss her almost perfunctorily in passing, and poured himself a glass of wine. I know what you're going to say, Sparhawk, she said.
Oh?
He gave her an innocent look.
You're angry with me, aren't you?
No, not really. What made you think I'd be angry?
She looked a bit less sure of herself.
You mean you're not? I thought you'd be raging by now. About my decision to pay a state visit to Tomalley, I mean.
No, actually, it's a very good idea. Of course, we'll have to take a few precautions to ensure your safety. But we always have to do that. So we're sort of used to it, aren't we?
What kind of precautions are we talking about here?
Her tone was suspicious.
Nothing all that extreme, dear. I don't think you should go walking in the forest alone or visiting thieves' dens without some sort of escort. I'm not talking about anything out of the ordinary, and you're used to certain restrictions on your movements already. We'll be in a strange country, and we don't know the people. I know that you'll trust me to sort of nose things out, and that you won't argue with me if I tell you that something's too dangerous. We can all live with that, I'm sure. You pay me to protect you, after all, so we won't have any silly little squabbles about security measures, now will we?
He kept his tone mild and sweetly reasonable, giving her no reason to raise any questions about exactly what he had in mind when he spoke of security measures.
You know much more about that sort of thing than I do, my love, she conceded. So I'll leave all that entirely in your hands. If a girl has a champion who just happens to be the greatest knight in the world, she'd be foolish not to pay attention to him, now wouldn't she?
My feelings exactly, he agreed.
It was a small victory, to be sure. But when one is dealing with a queen, victories of any kind are hard to come by.
Well, she said, rising to her feet, since we're not going to fight, why don't we go to bed?
Good idea.
The kitten Talon had given to Princess Danae was named Myrrh, and Myrrh had one habit that particularly irritated Sparhawk. Kittens like to have company when they sleep. And Myrrh had found that when Sparhawk slept, he curled up slightly, and that the space just behind his knees was a perfect place for her to nest. Sparhawk customarily slept with the covers pulled tightly around his neck, but that was no real problem. A cold, wet nose touched to the back of his neck caused him to flinch away violently, and that involuntary movement would always open just enough of a gap for an enterprising kitten. Myrrh found the whole process quite satisfactory, and even rather amusing. Sparhawk, however, did not. It was shortly before dawn when he emerged from the bedroom, tousled, sleepy-eyed, and just a bit out of sorts. Princess Danae wandered into the large central room, absently dragging Rollo behind her.
"Have you seen my cat?"
she asked her father.
"She's in bed with your mother," he replied shortly.
I should have known, I suppose. Myrrh likes the way Mother smells. She told me so herself.
Sparhawk glanced around and then carefully closed the bedroom door.
I need to talk with Sephrenia again, he said.
All right.
Not here, though. I'll find some place.
What happened last night?
We have to go to Tomalley.
I thought you were going to do something about Gricknot.
I am. In a way. It seems that there's something, or someone, over on the Darisian continent that's behind Dricknoth. I think we'll be able to find out more about him there than we ever would here. I'll make arrangements to have you taken back to Sumura.
She pursed her small mouth.
No, I don't think so, she said. I'd better go along with you.
That's absolutely out of the question.
Oh, Sparhawk, do grow up. I'm going along because you're going to need me when we get there.
She negligently tossed Rollo over into a corner.
I'm also going because you can't stop me. Come up with some reason for it, Sparhawk. Otherwise, you'll have to explain to Mother how it is that I managed to get ahead of you when you all find me sitting in a tree alongside a road somewhere. Get dressed, Father, and go find a place where we can talk privately.
Some time later, Sparhawk and his daughter climbed a narrow, spiraling wooden staircase that led to the cupola atop the dome of the basilica. There was quite probably no more private place in the world, particularly in view of the fact that the wooden stairs leading up to the little bell tower did not so much creak as they did shriek when anyone began to climb them. When they reached the unenclosed little house high above the city, Danae spent several minutes gazing out over Kyrellos. "You can always see so much better from up high like this," she said. "It's just about the only reason I've ever found for flying."
"Can you really fly?"
"Of course. Can't you?"
"You know better, Afriel."
"I was only teasing you, Sparhawk," she laughed. "Let's get started." She sat down, crossed her legs, and lifted her little face to sing that trilling song she had raised back in Sumura. Then, again, her eyes closed, and her face went blank as the song died away. "What is it this time, Sparhawk?" Sifrinia's voice was a bit tart.
"What's the matter, little mother?"
"Do you realize that it's the middle of the night here?"
"It is?"
"Of course it is. The sun's on your side of the world now."
"Astonishing. Though I suppose it stands to reason if you think about it. Did I disturb you?"
"Yes, as a matter of fact, you did."
"What were you doing so late at night?"
"None of your business. What do you want?"
"We'll be coming to Deresia soon."
"What?"
"The Emperor asked us to come. Well, he asked me, actually. The rest are sort of tagging along. Ilana's going to make a state visit to Mathurian, to sort of give us all an excuse for being there."
"Have you taken leave of your senses? Tamali's a very dangerous place right now."
"Probably not much more than Eosia is. We were attacked by ancient Lamorks on our way here to Kyrellos from Simura."
"Perhaps they were just modern-day Lamorks dressed in ancient garb."
"I rather doubt that, Sifrinia. They vanished when their attack began to fail."
"All of them?"
"Except for the ones who were already dead. Would a little logic offend you?"
"Not unless you drag it out."
"We're almost positive that the attackers really were ancient Lamorks. And Ambassador Oscania told us that someone's been raising antique heroes in Deresia as well. Logic implies that this resurrection business is originating in Tamali, and that its goal is to stir up nationalistic sentiments in order to weaken the central governments, the empire in Deresia, and the church here in Eosia. If we're right about the source of all this activity being somewhere in Tamali, that's the logical place to start looking for answers. Where are you right now?"
"Vanyan and I are at Sarsos in eastern Astel. You'd better come here, Sparhawk. These long-distance conversations tend to blur things."
Sparhawk thought for a moment, trying to remember the map of Deresia. "We'll come overland, then. I'll find some way to get the others to agree to that."
"Try not to take too long, Sparhawk. It's really very important that we talk face to face."
"Right. Sleep well, little mother."
"I wasn't sleeping."
"Oh. What were you doing?"
"Didn't you hear what she told you before, Sparhawk?" his daughter asked him.
"Which was that?"
"She told you that it was none of your business what she was doing." "What an astonishingly good idea, Your Majesty," Oscania said later that morning, when they had all gathered once again in Dolmont's private audience chamber. "I'd have never thought of it in a million years. The leaders of the subject nations of Tamali don't go to Mathurian unless they're summoned by His Imperial Majesty." "The rulers of Eosia are less restrained, Your Excellency," Anban told him. "They have total sovereignty." "Astonishing. Has your church no authority over their actions, Your Grace?" "Only in spiritual matters, I'm afraid."
"Isn't that inconvenient?" "You wouldn't believe how inconvenient, Ambassador Oscania."
Dolmont sighed, looking at Ilana reproachfully. "Be nice, Sarathi," she murmured. "Then no one is really in charge here in Eosia? No one has the absolute authority to make final decisions?" "It's a responsibility we share, Your Excellency," Ilana explained. "We enjoy sharing things, don't we, Sarathi?"
"Of course." Dolmont said it without much enthusiasm. The rough-and-tumble give-and-take nature of Eosian politics has a certain utility, Your Excellency, Stragan drawled. Consensus politics gives us the advantage of bringing together a wide range of views.
In Tamale, we feel that having only one view is far less confusing.
The Emperor's view? What happens when the Emperor happens to be an idiot? Or a madman?
The government usually works around him, Oscania admitted blandly. Such imperial misfortunes seldom live very long, however.
Ah, Stragan said.
Perhaps we should get down to work,
Emban said. He crossed the room to a large map of the known world hanging on the wall.
The fastest way to travel is by sea, he noted. We could sail from Mod-Del in Camoria, out through the inner sea, then around the southern tip of Daresia, and then up the east coast to Mathurian.
We? Sertinian asked.
Oh, didn't I tell you? Emban said. I'll be going along. Ostensibly, I'll be Queen Aelana's spiritual advisor. In actuality, I'll be the Archprelate's personal envoy.
It's probably wiser to keep the Alenian flavor of the expedition, Dolmont explained. For public consumption, anyway. Let's not complicate things by sending two separate missions to Mathurian simultaneously.
Sparhawk had to move quickly, and he didn't have much to work with.
Traveling by ship has certain advantages, he conceded. But I think there's a major drawback.
Oh,
Emban said.
It satisfies the requirements of a state visit right enough, but it doesn't do very much to address our real reason for going to Tamale. Your Excellency, what's likely to happen when we reach Mathurian?
The usual, Oscania shrugged. Audiences, banquets, reviewing troops, concerts, that giddy round of meaningless activity we all adore.
Precisely, Sparhawk agreed. And we won't really get anything done, will we?
Probably not.
But we aren't going to Tamale for a month-long carouse. What we're really going there for is to find out what's behind all the upheaval. We need information, not entertainment. And the information's probably out in the hinterlands, not in the capital. I think we should find some reason to go across country.
It was a practical suggestion, and it rather neatly concealed Sparhawk's real reason for wanting to go overland. Emban's expression was pained.
We'd be on the road for months that way.
We can get as much done as we'll accomplish in Mathurian by staying home, Your Grace. We have to get outside the capital.
Emban groaned.
You're absolutely bent on making me ride a horse all the way from here to Mathurian, aren't you, Sparhawk?
You could stay home, Your Grace, Sparhawk suggested. We could always take Patriarch Bergsten instead. He'd be better in a fight anyway. That will do, Sparhawk, Dolmont said firmly.
Consensus politics are very interesting, my Lord Stragan, Oscania observed. In Mathurian, we'd have followed the course suggested by the primate of Usera without any further discussion. We try to avoid raising the possibility of alternatives whenever possible.
Welcome to Eosia, Your Excellency, Stragan smiled.
Permission to speak?
Khalad said politely.
Of course, Dolmont replied.
Khalad rose, went to the map, and began measuring distance.
A good horse can cover 10 leagues a day, and a good ship can cover 30, if the wind holds.
He frowned and looked around.
Why is Talon never around when you need him? He muttered. He can compute these numbers in his head. I have to count them up on my fingers.
He said he had something to take care of, Barrett told him. Khalad grunted.
All we're really interested in is what's going on in Daresia, so there's no need to ride across Eosia. We could sail from Mod-Del the way Patriarch Emban suggested. Go out through the inner sea and up the east coast of Zemach to...
He looked at the map and then pointed.
To Celestia here. That's 900 leagues. 30 days. If we were to follow the roads, it'd probably be the same distance overland, but that would take us 90 days. We'd save 2 months at least.
Well, Emban conceded grudgingly, that's something, anyway.
Sparhawk was fairly sure that they could save much more than 60 days. He looked across the room at his daughter, who was playing with her kitten under Mirtai's watchful eye. Princess Danae was quite frequently present at conferences where she had no real business. People did not question her presence for some reason. Sparhawk knew that the child goddess Afriel could tamper with the passage of time, but he was not entirely certain that she could manage it so undetectably in her present incarnation as she had when she had been Flute. Princess Danae looked back at him and rolled her eyes upward with resigned expression that spoke volumes about his limited understanding. Then she gravely nodded her head. Sparhawk breathed somewhat easier after that. Now we come to the question of the Queen's security, he continued. Ambassador Oscania, how large a retinue could my wife take with her without raising eyebrows?
The conventions are a little vague on that score, Sir Sparhawk.
Sparhawk looked around at his friends. If I thought I could get away with it, I'd take the whole body of the militant orders with me, he said.
We've defined our trip as a visit, Sparhawk, Tinian said. Not an invasion. Would 100 armored knights alarm His Imperial Majesty, Your Excellency?
It's a symbolic sort of number, Oscania agreed after a moment's consideration. Large enough for a show, but not so large as to appear threatening. We'll be going through Estelle, and you can pick up an escort of Aetons in the capital at Darsus. A sizable escort for a state visitor shouldn't raise too many eyebrows. 25 knights from each order, wouldn't you think, Sparhawk? Bivier suggested. The differences in our equipment and the colors of our surcoats would make the knights appear more ceremonial than utilitarian. 100 pandions by themselves might cause concern in some quarters.
Good idea, Sparhawk agreed.
You can bring more if you want, Sparhawk, Mirtai told him. There are Paloi on the steps of Central Astel. They're the descendants of Kring's ancestors. He might just want to visit his cousins in Deresia.
Ah, yes, Oscania said. The Paloi. I'd forgotten that you had those wild men here in Eosia, too. They're an excitable and sometimes unreliable people. Are you certain that this Kring person would be willing to accompany us?
Kring would ride into fire if I asked him to, Mirtai replied confidently.
The Domi is much taken with our Mirtai, Your Excellency, Ilana smiled. He comes to Samura 3 or 4 times a year to propose marriage to her.
The Paloi are warriors, Aetana, Oscania noted. You would not demean yourself in the eyes of your people were you to accept him.
Husbands take their wives more or less for granted, Oscania, Mirtai pointed out with a mysterious little smile. A suitor, on the other hand, is much more attentive, and I rather enjoy Kring's attentions. He writes very nice poetry. He compared me to a golden sunrise once. I thought that was rather pretty.
You never wrote any poetry for me, Sparhawk, Ilana accused her husband.
The Aline language is limited, my queen, he responded. It has no words which could do you justice.
Nice try, Carlton murmured. I think we all might want to spend a bit of time on some correspondence at this point, Dolmont told them. There are all sorts of arrangements to be made. I'll put a fast ship at your disposal, Ambassador Oscania. You'll want to advise your emperor that the Queen of Alenia is coming to call.
With the archprelate's permission, I'll communicate with my government by dispatch, rather than in person. There are social and political peculiarities in various parts of the empire. I could be very helpful in smoothing Her Majesty's path if I went with her.
I'll be very pleased to have a civilized gentleman along, Your Excellency. Ilana smiled. You have no idea what it's like being surrounded by men whose clothes all have been tailored by blacksmiths.
Talon entered the chamber with an excited expression on his face.
Where have you been?
The question came from several parts of the room.
It's such a comfort to be so universally loved that my activities arouse this breathless curiosity,
the boy said with an exaggerated and sardonic bow. I'm quite overwhelmed by this demonstration of affection. Ambassador Oscania looked quizzically at Dolmont. It would take far too long to explain, Your Excellency, Dolmont said wearily. Just keep a close watch on your valuables when that boy's in the room.
Sarathi, Talon protested, I haven't stolen a single thing for almost a week now.
That's a start, I suppose,
Amban noted. Old habits die hard, Your Grace, Talon smirked. Anyway, since you're all dying to know, I was out in the city sort of nosing around, and I ran across an old friend. Would you believe that Krager's here in Kyrellos?
Part 2. Astell. Chapter 7. Comier, Sparhawk's letter began. My wife's making a state visit to Matherian in Tomalee. We've discovered that the present turmoil in Lamorkand is probably originating in Deresia, so we're using Ilana's trip to give us the chance to go there to see what we can find out. I'll keep you advised. I'm borrowing 25 Genidian knights from your local chapter house to serve as a part of the honor guard. I'd suggest that you do what you can to keep Avon Wargensen from cementing any permanent alliances with Count Garrick in Lamorkand. Garrick is rather deeply involved in some kind of grand plan that goes far beyond the borders of Lamorkand itself. Dolmont probably wouldn't be too displeased if you, Darylin, and Abriel can contrive some excuse to go to Lamorkand and step on the fellow's neck. Watch out for magic, though. Garrick's getting help from somebody who knows more than he's supposed to. Ulaf's sending you more details. Sparhawk.
Isn't that just a little blunt beer?
Ilana said, leaning over her husband's shoulder. She smelled very good. Comier's a blunt sort of fellow, Ilana. Sparhawk shrugged, laying down his quill. And I'm not really very good at writing letters.
I noticed. They were in their ornate apartments, in one of the church buildings adjoining the basilica, where they had spent the day composing messages to people scattered over most of the continent.
Don't you have letters of your own to write? Sparhawk asked his wife.
I'm all finished. All I really had to do was send a short note to Lenda. He knows what to do.
She glanced across the room at Mirtai, who sat patiently snipping the tips off Myr's claws.
Myr was not taking it very well. Ilana smiled.
Mirtai's communication with Kring was much more direct. She called in an itinerant Paloi and told him to ride to Kring with her command to ride to Bosna on the Zemok-Astell border with 100 of his tribesmen. She said that if he isn't waiting when she gets there, she'll take it to mean that he doesn't love her.
Ilana pushed her pale blonde hair back from her brow. Poor Kring, Sparhawk smiled. She could raise him from the dead with a message like that. Do you think she'll ever really marry him?
That's very hard to say, Sparhawk.
He does have her attention, though. There was a knock at the door, and Mirtai rose to let Kalthan in. It's a beautiful day out there, the blonde man told them. We'll have good weather for the trip. How are things coming along? Sparhawk asked him. We're just about all ready.
Kalthan was wearing a green brocade doublet, and he bowed extravagantly to the queen.
Actually, we are ready. About the only things happening now are the usual redundancies.
Could you clarify that just a bit, Sir Kalthan?
Ilana said. He shrugged. Everyone's going over all the things everyone else has done to make sure that nothing's been left out. He sprawled in the chair. We're surrounded by busybodies, Sparhawk. Nobody seems to be able to believe that anybody else can do something right. If Amban asks me if the knights are all ready to ride even one more time, I think I'll strangle him.
He has no idea at all about what's involved in moving a large group of people from one place to another. Would you believe that he was going to try to put all of us on one ship, horses and all?
That might have been just a bit crowded, Ilana smiled.
How many ships did he finally decide on?
I'm still not sure. I still don't know for certain how many people are going.
Your attendants are all absolutely convinced that you'll simply die without their company, my queen.
There are about 40 or so who are making preparations for the trip.
You'd better weed them out, Elana, Sparhawk suggested. I don't want to be saddled with the entire court.
I will need a few people, Sparhawk, if only for the sake of appearances.
Talon came into the room. The gangly boy was wearing what he called his street clothes, slightly mismatched, very ordinary, and just this side of shabby.
He's still out there, he said, his eyes bright.
Who? Carlton asked.
Krager. He's creeping around Kyrellos like a lost puppy looking for a home. Stragan's got people from the local thieves' community watching him. We haven't been able to figure out exactly what he's up to just yet. If Martell were still alive, I'd almost say he's doing the same sort of thing he used to do, letting himself be seen.
How does he look?
Worse.
Talon's voice cracked slightly. It was still hovering somewhere between soprano and baritone.
The years aren't treating Krager very well. His eyes look like they've been poached in bacon grease. He looks absolutely miserable.
I think I can bear Krager's misery, Sparhawk noted. He's beginning to make me just a little tired, though. He's been hovering around the edge of my awareness for the last 10 years or more, sort of like a hangnail or an ingrown toenail. He always seems to be working for the other side, but he's too insignificant to really worry about.
Stragan could ask one of the local thieves to cut his throat, Talon offered.
Sparhawk considered it.
Maybe not, he decided. Krager's always been a good source of information.
Tell Stragan that if the opportunity happens to come up, we might want to have a little chat with our old friend, though.
The offer to braid his legs together usually makes Krager very talkative.
Olaf stopped by about a half hour later.
Did you finish that letter to Comier? He asked Sparhawk.
He has a draft copy, Sir Olaf, Elana replied for her husband. It definitely needs some polish.
You don't have to polish things for Comier, Your Majesty. He is used to strange letters. One of my Genidian brothers sent him a report written on human skin once.
She stared at him.
He did what?
There wasn't anything else handy to write on. A Genidian knight just arrived with a message for me from Comier, though. The knight's going back to Emsat, and he can carry Sparhawk's letter if it's ready to go.
It's close enough, Sparhawk said, folding the parchment and dribbling candle wax on it to seal it.
What did Comier have to say?
It was good news for a change. All the trolls have left Felicia for some reason.
Where did they go?
Who knows? Who cares?
The people who live in the country they've gone to might be slightly interested, Carlton suggested.
That's their problem, Olaf shrugged. It's funny, though. The trolls don't really get along with each other. I couldn't even begin to guess at a reason why they'd all decide to pack up and leave at the same time. The discussions must have been very interesting. They usually kill each other on sight.
There's not much help I can give you, Sparhawk, Dolmont said gravely when the two of them met privately later that day.
The church is fragmented in Deresia. They don't accept the authority of Kyrellos, so I can't order them to assist you.
Dolmont's face was careworn, and his white cassock made his complexion look sallow. In a very real sense, Dolmont ruled an empire that stretched from Thalesia to Camoria, and the burdens of his office bore down on him heavily. The change they had all noticed in their friend in the past several years derived more likely from that than from any kind of inflated notion of his exalted station.
You'll get more cooperation in Astel than either Edom or Daconia, he continued. The doctrine of the Church of Astel is very close to ours, close enough that we even recognize Astelian ecclesiastical rank. Edom and Daconia broke away from the Astelian Church thousands of years ago and went their own way. The archprelate smiled ruefully.
The sermons in those two kingdoms are generally little more than hysterical denunciations of the Church of Kyrellos, and of me personally. They're anti-hierarchical, much like the Rendors.
if you should happen to go into those two kingdoms, you can expect the church there to oppose you. The fact that you're a church knight will be held against you, rather than the reverse. The children there are all taught that the knights of the church have horns and tails. They'll expect you to burn churches, murder clergymen, and enslave the people.
I'll do what I can to stay away from those places, Sarathi, Sparhawk assured him. Who's in charge in Estel?
The Archimandrite of Darsis is nominally the head of the Estelian Church. It's an obscure rank, approximately the equivalent of our patriarch. The Church of Estel's organized along monastic lines. They don't have a secular clergy there.
Are there any other significant differences I should know about?
Some of the customs are different, liturgical variations primarily. I doubt that you'll be asked to conduct services, so that shouldn't cause any problems. It's probably just as well. I heard you deliver a sermon once.
Sparhawk smiled. We serve in different ways, Sarathi. Our Holy Mother didn't hire me to preach to people. How do I address the Archimandrite of Darsis, in case I meet him?
Call him Your Grace, the same as you would a patriarch. He's an imposing man with a huge beard, and there's nothing in Estel that he doesn't know about. His priests are everywhere. The people trust them implicitly, and they all submit weekly reports to the Archimandrite. The church has enormous power there.
What a novel idea.
Don't mistreat me, Sparhawk. Things haven't been going very well for me lately.
Would you be willing to listen to an assessment, Dolma?
Of me personally? Probably not.
I wasn't talking about that. You're too old to change, I expect. I'm talking about your policies in Rendor. Your basic idea was good enough, but you went at it the wrong way.
Be careful, Sparhawk. I've sent men to monasteries permanently for less than that.
Your policy of reconciliation with the Rendors was very sound. I spent 10 years down there, and I know how they think. The ordinary people in Rendor would really like to be reconciled with the church, if for no other reason than to get rid of all the howling fanatics out in the desert. Your policy is good, but you sent the wrong people there to carry it out.
The priests I sent are all experts in doctrine, Sparhawk.
That's the problem. You sent doctrinaire fanatics down there. All they want to do is punish the Rendors for their heresy.
Heresy is a sort of problem, Sparhawk.
The heresy of the Rendors isn't theological, Dolmont. They worship the same God we do, and their body of religious belief is identical to ours. The disagreements between us are entirely in the field of church government. The church was corrupt when the Rendors broke away from us. The members of the hierocracy were sending relatives to fill church positions in Rendor, and those relatives were parasitic opportunists who were far more interested in lining their own purses than caring for the souls of the people. When you get right down to it, that's why the Rendors started murdering primates and priests, and they're doing it for exactly the same reason now. You'll never reconcile the Rendors to the church if you try to punish them. They don't care who's governing our Holy Mother. They'll never see you personally, my friend, but they will see their local priest. Probably every day. If he spends all his time calling them heretics and tearing the veils off their women, they'll kill him. It's as simple as that.
Dolmont's face was troubled. Perhaps I have blundered, he admitted. Of course, if you tell anybody I said that, I'll deny it.
Naturally.
All right, what should I do about it?
Sparhawk remembered something then. There's a vicar in a poor church in Borata, he said. He's probably the closest thing to a saint I've ever seen, and I didn't even get his name. Barrett knows what it is, though. Disguise some investigators as beggars and send them down to Camoria to observe him. He's exactly the kind of man you need.
Why not just send for him?
He'd be too tongue-tied to speak to you, Sarathi. He's what they had in mind when they coined the word humble. Besides, he'd never leave his flock. If you order him to Kyrellos and then send him to Rendor, he'll probably die within 6 months. He's that kind of man.
Dolmont's eyes suddenly filled with tears.
You trouble me, Sparhawk, he said. You trouble me. That's the ideal we all had when we took holy orders.
He sighed.
How did we all get so far away from it? You got too much involved in the world, Dolmont, Sparhawk told him gently. The church had to live in the world, but the world corrupts her much faster than she can redeem it. What's the answer to that problem, Sparhawk?
I honestly don't know, Sarathi. Maybe there isn't any.
Sparhawk!
It was his daughter's voice, and it was somehow inside his head. He was passing through the nave of the basilica, and he quickly knelt as if in prayer to cover what he was really doing.
What is it, Afriel?
He asked silently.
You don't have to genuflect to me, Sparhawk.
Her voice was amused.
I'm not.
If they catch me walking through the corridors, mouthing long conversations with somebody who isn't there, they'll lock me up in an asylum.
You look very reverential in that position, though. I'm touched.
Was there something significant, or are you just amusing yourself?
Sophrenia wants to talk to you again.
All right. I'm in the nave right now. Come down and meet me here. We'll go up to the cupola again.
I'll meet you up there.
There's only one stairway leading up there, Afriel. We have to climb it.
You might have to, but I don't. I don't like going into the nave, Sparhawk. I always have to stop and talk with your god, and he's so tedious most of the time.
Sparhawk's mind shuddered back from the implications of that. The dried-out wooden stairs circling up to the top of the dome still shrieked their protest as Sparhawk mounted. It was a long climb, and he was winded when he reached the top.
What took you so long?
Danae asked him. She wore a simple white smock. It was a little girl sort of dress, so no one seemed to even notice that its cut was definitely stearic.
You enjoy saying things like that to me, don't you? Sparhawk accused.
I'm only teasing, Father.
She laughed.
I hope no one saw you coming up here. I don't think the world's ready for a flying princess just yet.
No one saw me, Sparhawk. I've done this before, you know. Trust me.
Do I have any choice? Let's get to work. I've still got a lot left to do today, if we're going to leave tomorrow morning.
She nodded and sat cross-legged near one of the huge bells. She lifted her face again and raised that flute-like trill. Then her voice drifted off, and her face went blank.
"Where have you been?"
Sophrenia asked, opening Danae's eyes to stare at her pupil. He sighed.
"If you two don't stop that, I'm going to go into another line of work."
"Has Afriel been teasing you again?"
she asked.
"Of course she has. Did you know that she can fly?"
"I've never seen her do it, but I'd assumed she could."
"What did you want to see me about?"
I've been hearing disturbing rumors. The northern Atons have been seeing some very large, shaggy creatures in the forest near their north coast.
So that's where they went.
Don't be cryptic, dear one.
Komiye sent word to Olaf. It seems that the trolls have all left the leisure.
The trolls?
She exclaimed.
They wouldn't do that. The leisure's their ancestral home.
Maybe you'd better go tell the trolls about that. Komiye swears that there's not a single one of them left in Thalesia.
Something very, very strange is going on here, Sparhawk.
Ambassador Oscania said more or less the same thing.
Can the Styrix there at Sarsos make any sense out of it yet?
No. Zalasta's at his wit's end.
Have you come up with any idea at all of who's behind it?
Sparhawk. We don't even know what's behind it. We can't even make a guess about the species of whatever it is.
We sort of keep coming back to the idea that it's the troll gods again. Something had to have enough authority over the trolls to command them to leave Thalesia, and that points directly at the troll gods. Are we absolutely sure that they haven't managed to get loose?
It's not a good idea to discount any possibility when you're dealing with gods, Sparhawk. I don't know the spell Gwerig used when he put them inside the Bellium, so I don't know if it can be broken.
Then it is possible.
That's what I just said, dear one. Have you seen that shadow or the cloud lately?
No.
Has Athriel ever seen it?
No.
She could tell you, but I'd rather not have her exposed to whatever it is. Perhaps we can come up with a way to lure it out when you get here, so that I can take a look at it. When are you leaving?
First thing tomorrow morning. Danae sort of told me that she can play with time the way she did when we were marching to Ossie with Wargan's army. That would get us there faster. But can she do it as undetectably now as she did when she was flute?
The bell behind the motionless form of his daughter gave a deep, soft-toned sound.
Why don't you ask me, Sparhawk?
Danae's voice hummed in the bell sound.
It's not as if I weren't here, you know.
How was I supposed to know that?
He waited.
Well, he asked the still humming bell, can you?
Well, of course I can, Sparhawk.
The child goddess sounded irritated.
Don't you know anything?
That will do, Sophronia chided.
He's such a lump.
Athriel, I said that will do. You will not be disrespectful to your father. A faint smile touched the lips of the apparently somnolent little princess. Even if he is a hopeless lump.
If you two want to discuss my failings, I'll go back downstairs so you can speak freely, Sparhawk told them.
No, that's all right, Sparhawk, Athriel said lightly. We're all friends, so we shouldn't have any secrets from each other.
They left Kyrellos the following morning and rode south on the Archean side of the River Saron in bright morning sunshine, with 100 church knights in full armor riding escort. The grass along the riverbank was very green, and the blue sky was dotted with fluffy white clouds. After some discussion, Sparhawk and Aelana had decided that the attendants she would need for the sake of appearances could be drawn for the most part from the ranks of the church knights.
Stragan can coach them, Sparhawk had told his wife. He's had a certain amount of experience, so he can make honest knights look like useless butterflies.
It had been necessary, however, to include one lady-in-waiting, Baroness Melodir, a young woman of Aelana's own age, with honey-blonde hair, deep blue eyes, and an apparently empty head. Aelana also took along a personal maid, a doe-eyed girl named Aileen. The two of them rode in the carriage with the queen, Myrtai, Danae, and Stragan, who, dressed in his elegant best, kept them amused with light banter. Sparhawk reasoned that between them, Stragan and Myrtai, could provide his wife and daughter with a fairly significant defense if the occasion arose. Patriarch Emban was going to be a problem. Sparhawk could see that after they had gone no more than a few miles. Emban was not comfortable on a horse, and he filled the air with complaints as he rode.
That isn't going to work, you know, Colton observed about mid-morning. Churchmen or not, if the knights have to listen to Emban feel sorry for himself all the way across the Darisian continent, he's likely to have some kind of an accident before we get to Methyrian. I'm ready to drown him right now myself, and the river's very handy.
Sparhawk thought about it. He looked at the queen's carriage.
That landau's not quite big enough, he told his friend. I think we need something grander. 6 horses are more impressive than 4 anyway. See if you can find Bevier.
When the olive-skinned Archean rode forward, Sparhawk explained the situation.
If we don't get Emban off that horse, it's going to take us a year to cross Deresia. Are you still on speaking terms with your cousin Lycian?
Of course. We're the best of friends.
Why don't you ride on ahead and have a chat with him? We need a large carriage. Roomy enough for 8. 6 horses, probably. We'll put Emban and Ambassador Oscania in the carriage with my wife and her entourage. Ask your cousin to locate one for us.
That might be expensive, Sparhawk, Bevier said dubiously.
That's all right, Bevier. The church will pay for it. After a week on horseback, Emban should be willing to sign for anything that doesn't wear a saddle.
Oh, as long as you're going there anyway. Have our ships moved upriver to Lycian's docks. Model's not so attractive a city that any of us would enjoy a stay there all that much, and Lycian's docks are more conveniently arranged.
Will we need anything else, Sparhawk? Bevier asked.
Not that I can think of. Feel free to improvise, though. Add anything you can think of on your way to Model. For once, we have a more or less unlimited budget at our disposal. The coffers of the church are wide open to us.
I wouldn't tell that to Stragan or Talon, my friend, Bevier laughed. I'll be at Lycian's house. I'll see you when you get there.
He wheeled his horse and rode south at a gallop.
Why didn't you just have him pick up another carriage for Emban and Oscania? Carlton asked. Because I don't want to have to defend two when we get to Tomalley.
Oh, that makes sense. Sort of.
They arrived at the house of Sir Bevier's cousin, Marquis Lycian, late one afternoon, and met Bevier and his stout, florid-faced kinsman in the graveled court in front of Lycian's opulent home. The Marquis bowed deeply to the Queen of Alenia and insisted that she accept his hospitality during her stay in Model. Carlton dispersed the knights in Lycian's park-like grounds.
Did you find a carriage? Sparhawk asked Bevier.
Bevier nodded.
It's large enough for our purposes, he said a bit dubiously. But the cost of it may turn Patriarch Emban's hair white.
I wouldn't be too sure, Sparhawk said. Let's ask him.
They crossed the graveled court to where the Patriarch of Usera stood beside his horse, clinging to his saddle horn with a look of profound misery on his face.
Pleasant little ride, wasn't it, Your Grace?
Sparhawk asked the fat man brightly. Emban groaned.
I don't think I'll be able to walk for a week.
Of course we were only strolling, Sparhawk continued. We'll have to move along much faster when we get to Tomalley.
He paused.
May I speak frankly, Your Grace?
You will anyway, Sparhawk, Emban said sourly. Would you really pay any attention to me if I objected?
Probably not. You're slowing us down, you know.
Well, excuse me.
You're not really built for horseback riding, Patriarch Emban. Your talent's in your head, not your backside.
Emban's eyes narrowed with hostility.
Go on, he said in an ominous tone of voice.
Since we're in a hurry, we've decided to put wheels under you. Would you be more comfortable in a cushioned carriage, Your Grace?
Sparhawk, I could kiss you.
I'm a married man, Your Grace. My wife might misunderstand. For security reasons, one carriage is far better than two. So I've taken the liberty of locating one that's somewhat larger than the one Elana rode down from Kyrellos. You wouldn't mind riding with her, would you? We thought we'd put you and Ambassador Oscania in the carriage with my queen and her attendants. Would that be satisfactory?
Did you want me to kiss the ground you're standing on, Sparhawk?
Oh, that won't be necessary, Your Grace. All you really have to do is sign the authorization for the carriage. This is urgent church business, after all. So the purchase of the carriage is fully justified, wouldn't you say?
Where do I sign?
Emban's expression was eager.
A carriage that large is expensive, Your Grace, Sparhawk warned him.
I'd pawn the basilica itself if it'd keep me out of that saddle.
You see? Sparhawk said to Bevier as they walked away. That wasn't hard at all, was it?
How did you know he'd agree so quickly?
Timing, Bevier. Timing. Later on, he might have objected to the price. You need to ask that sort of question while the man you're asking is still in pain.
You're a cruel fellow, Sparhawk.
Bevier laughed.
All sorts of people have said that to me from time to time. Sparhawk replied blandly. My people will finish loading the supplies for your voyage today, Sparhawk,
Marquis Lycian said as they rode toward the riverside village and its wharves on the edge of his estate.
You'll be able to sail with the morning tide.
You're a true friend, my lord, Sparhawk told him.
You're always here when we need you. You're exaggerating my benevolence, Sir Sparhawk,
Lycian laughed.
I'm making a very handsome profit by outfitting your vessels. I like to see friends get on in the world.
Lycian looked back over his shoulder at the Queen of Alenia, who rode a gray palfrey some distance to the rear.
You're the luckiest man in the world, Sparhawk, he observed. Your wife is the most beautiful woman I've ever seen.
I'll tell her you said that, Marquis Lycian. I'm sure she'll be pleased.
Elana and Amban had decided to accompany them as they rode down to the Marquis Enclave on the river, Elana to inspect the accommodations aboard ship, and Amban to have a look at the carriage he had just purchased. The flotilla moored to Lycian's wharves consisted of a dozen large, well-fitted vessels. Ships that made the merchantmen moored nearby look scruffy by comparison. Lycian led the way through the village that had grown up around the wharves toward where the river sparkled in the morning sun.
Master Clough!
The voice was not unlike a foghorn. Sparhawk turned in his saddle.
Well, strike me down if it isn't Captain Sorguy, he said with genuine pleasure. He liked the blunt, silvery-haired sea captain with whom he had spent so many hours.
He swung down from Farron's back and warmly clasped his friend's hand.
I haven't seen you in a dog's age, Master Clough, Sorguy said expansively. Are you still running from those cousins?
Sparhawk pulled a long face and sighed mournfully. It was just too good an opportunity to pass up.
No, he replied in a broken voice. Not anymore, I'm afraid. I made the mistake of staying in an alehouse in Apalia up in northern Pelosia for one last tankard. The cousins caught up with me there. Were you able to escape?
Sorguy's face mirrored his concern.
There were a dozen of them, Captain, and they were on me before I could even move. They clapped me in irons and took me to the estate of the ugly heiress I told you about. They didn't force you to marry her, did they?
Sorguy asked, sounding shocked.
I'm afraid so, my friend, Sparhawk said in a tragic voice. That's my wife on that gray horse there.
He pointed at the radiant Queen of Alenia. Captain Sorguy stared, his eyes growing wider and his mouth gaping open.
Horrible, isn't it?
Sparhawk said, with a broken-hearted catch in his voice. Chapter 8 Baroness Melodir was a pretty girl with hair the color of honey and eyes as blue as a summer sky. She did not have a brain in her head. At least, that was what she wanted people to believe. In actuality, the Baroness was probably more clever than most of the people in Elana's court, but she had learned early in life that people with limited intelligence feel threatened by pretty, clever young women, and she had perfected a vapid, empty-headed smile, a look of blank incomprehension, and a silly giggle. She erected these defenses as the situation required and kept her own counsel. Queen Elana saw through the subterfuge and even encouraged it. Melodir was very observant and had excellent hearing. People tend not to pay much attention to brainless girls. They say things in their presence they might not ordinarily say. Melodir always reported these conversational lapses back to the Queen, and so Elana found the Baroness useful to have around. Melodir, however, drove Stragan absolutely wild. He knew with complete certainty that she could not be as stupid as she appeared, but he could never catch her off guard. Aline, the Queen's maid, was quite another matter. Her mind was very ordinary, but her nature was such that people automatically loved her. She was sweet, gentle, and loving. She had brown hair and enormous, soft brown eyes. She was shy and modest and seldom spoke. Colton looked upon her as his natural prey, much as the wolf looks upon deer with a proprietary sense of ownership. Colton was fond of maids. They did not usually threaten him, and he could normally proceed with them without any particular fear of failure. The ship in which they sailed from Mardell that spring was well appointed. It belonged to the church, and it had been built to convey high-ranking churchmen and their servants to various parts of Eosia.
There was a certain neat, cozy quality about all ship cabins. They were uniformly constructed of dark-stained wood, the oily stain being a necessary protection for wood perpetually exposed to excessive humidity. The furniture would be stationary, resisting all efforts to rearrange it, since it was customarily bolted to the floor to prevent its migration from one part of the cabin to another in rough weather. Since the ceiling of a ship's cabin was in reality the underside of the deck overhead, where the sailors are working, the dark supporting beams were substantial. In the particular vessel upon which the Queen of Alenia and her entourage sailed, there was a large cabin in the stern with a broad window running across the back of the ship. It was a sort of floating audience chamber, ideally suited for gatherings. Because of the window at the back, the cabin was light and airy, and since the vessel was moved by her sails, the wind always came from astern, and it efficiently carried the smell of the bilges forward for the crew to enjoy in their cramped quarters in the forecastle. On the second day out, Sparhawk and Elana dressed themselves in plain utilitarian garments and went up to what had come to be called the throne room from their private cabin just below. Aileen was preparing Princess Danae's breakfast over a cunning little utensil that was part lamp and part stove. Aileen prepared most of Danae's meals, since she accepted the child's dietary prejudices without question. There was a polite knock. Then Calton and Stragan entered. Calton bore himself strangely, half crouched, twisted off to one side, and quite obviously in pain.
"What happened to you?" Sparhawk asked him.
"I tried to sleep in a hammock," Calton groaned. "Since we're at sea, I thought it was the thing to do. I think I've ruined myself, Sparhawk." Mirtai rose from her chair near the door. "Stand still," she peremptorily ordered the blonde man.
"What are you doing?" he demanded suspiciously.
"Be quiet." She ran one hand up his back, gently probing with her fingertips. "Lie down on the floor," she commanded, "on your stomach."
"Not very likely."
"Do you want me to kick your feet out from under you?" Grumbling, he painfully lowered himself to the deck.
"Is this going to hurt?" he asked.
"It won't hurt me a bit," she assured him, removing her sandals. "Try to relax." Then she started to walk on him. There were crackling noises and loud pops. There were also gasps and cries of pain as Calton writhed under her feet. She finally paused, thoughtfully probing at a stubborn spot between his shoulder blades with her toes. Then she raised up on her toes and came down quite firmly. Calton's shriek was strangled as his breath whooshed out, and the noise that came from his back was very loud, much like the sound that might come from a tree trunk being snapped in two. He lay face down, gasping and groaning.
"Don't be such a baby," Mirtai told him heartlessly. "Get up."
"I can't. You killed me."
She picked him up by one arm and set him on his feet.
"Walk around," she commanded him.
"Walk? I can't even breathe."
She drew one of her daggers.
"All right, all right. Don't get excited. I'm walking."
"Swing your arms back and forth."
"Why?"
"Just do it, Calton. You've got to loosen up those muscles."
He walked back and forth, swinging his arms and gingerly turning his head back and forth.
"You know, I hate to admit it, but I do feel better. Much better, actually."
"Naturally."
She put her dagger away.
"You didn't have to be so rough, though."
"I can put you back into exactly the same condition as you were when you came in, if you'd like."
"No, that's quite all right, Mirtai."
He said it very quickly and backed away from her. End of Side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.